Welcome to Unspeakable, the podcast of the Cthulhu Mythos Gaming Magazine, The Unspeakable Oath. This is episode 11, hosted by Ross Payton, that's me, of Slang Design and Roleplaying Public Radio. We also have Scott Glancy of Pagan Publishing, Shane Ivey of Arc Dream Publishing, and our guest today is game designer, editor, and podcaster Ryan Macklin. So, say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan. Oh, that was not all of us? It was just Ryan? Oh.
Well, you guys are always here. I mean, you know, like it or not.
I'm not guests. I am always there, too. I am like the faceless old woman who lives secretly in your house.
We're going to be talking about player agency in horror games. But before we get to that, we, of course, have to thank our sponsors. So, Shane, would you like to start with that?
Yeah. As always, thank you. People that advertise in the Unspeakable Oath, Atlas Games, and a bunch of these have been with us from the beginning, but their book, Where the Deep Ones Are, is a sort of Cthulhu story for kids, and they have a whole mess of them. If you go to atlasgames.com/Cthulhu4Kids, that's the numeral 4Kids, they have a special bundle deal where you can get a bunch of Ken Heitz really funny, creepy storybooks at a great price. Innsmouth Free Press, with their new book Sword and Mythos, is backing us, as they have from the beginning. Thank you, Sylvia. And if that's at InnsmouthFreePress.com. And Sword and Mythos is sort of it's an anthology of swords and sorcery stories through the Cthulhu mythos, sort of. So it's, you know, swords and sorcery and horror in the vein of your Robert E. Howard. And
I have actually read that. I'm going to review it for an upcoming. Well, I can give a sort of brief review here.
Yeah.
I actually got the ebook version.
Don't say so, because there are sponsors and we're their friends.
Well, I'm going to review it for RPPR as well. I read it, and it's a great compilation of stories, because they're not just set in like generic sort of medieval Europe. They're set throughout history, from ancient China to Africa to sort of pirate age. And the way a lot of the stories work so well is because they're treated as like they're the 18th supplement or 18th chapter or serial of this character, this heroic character fighting unusual mythos entities. And so you're just thrown into the middle of this chaos, and you're like trying to pick up what's going on by context. And it's
Buckaroo Banzai.
Some of them are actually quite horrific. There's actually one set in the biblical era, based on a story from the Old Testament.
Well, what's more horrible than the Old Testament?
Yeah, well, adding the mythos to it, believe it or not, it makes it even worse. The one in China is actually really fairly creepy, and there's one set in Carcosa, which I quite enjoyed.
You hate it. That would be the worst thing for Ross, is to bring on Carcosa.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's a great read. I'll have a longer review of that in the next episode of RPPR. I meant to review it earlier, but we had our 100th episode recently. So highly recommend.
Super. So what else? We have Arkham Gazette is helping us out this issue as well. That's a magazine. It's a free downloadable magazine that's put together by Brett Kramer, who's a frequent contributor to the Unspeakable Oath.
Really one of the best. Every time the name Brett Kramer is mentioned, I have to say, holy crap.
Yeah.
That guy is a damn good writer.
Mm-hmm. So issue 2 has been available for a couple of months now. That has things, more locations in Innsmouth, and a look at Polynesian culture and traditions, and a hymnal for the Esoteric Order of Dagon, and stuff about the Pawnee scripture. Lots of just sort of every issue was kind of a grab bag of.
You had me at Polynesia.
Yeah. So they're at sentinelhillpress.wordpress.com or Arkham Gazette. And Golden Goblin Press is another one of our backers this issue. That's a prolific scenario author and editor, Oscar Rios's imprint. So they have Tales from the Crescent City that just funded on Kickstarter recently and is in development. And then they'll launch in September a Kickstarter for a new book called De Horror Cosmico, which is for the what is it, Cthulhu Invictus, the Roman Imperial Roman supplement. And then they have Island of Ignorance, which funded a while ago, which is available now, the third Cthulhu companion. And it's they've always got a great collection of really, really good material by a lot of times the same stable of writers that we borrow from, which is why we know they're good. And what else? The H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival is back. They've got another their next festival in Los Angeles is in September at hplfilmfestival.com. And Scott, you're always at the Portland one, but
yeah, and I do want to point out that the Portland one is going to be having a best of show October the 4th of this year. They're doing a best of show. Because they're going to be moving the festival back to October. What they discovered when they split up the festival into Long Beach and Portland mm-hmm. was that having the show on two different times of the year did not get people going to, you know, both shows. You know, people still made decisions about which show they were going to do based on the geography. You know, you could not tempt people up from Southern California to Portland if there was one down south. So they've decided to move their show back to October. So next year, 2015, it will be October 2nd through 4th. It will be moved out of – it used to be in March in the spring. So now to sort of tease that, they're going to have a October 4th Best of the Fest event at the Hollywood Theater, of course.
Right, right. All right. All right. Well, good. So there's that, and then September 26th to 28th is the LA Festival
mm-hmm.
as well. Okay. So super. So again, thank you everybody for backing The Oath and helping us to make the magazine possible. You're one.
Hey, I advertise in The Oath. When does Pagan Publishing get some love here? Oh wait, I don't have to pay to advertise in The Oath.
There's that.
Okay. There's that problem.
Yeah.
Well, I think next up we have our announcement. So speaking of, you know, tooting your own horn, Scott, would you like to do you have some announcements you'd like to share?
Yes. We'll start with I guess we'll do that. We'll work our way forward. Yeah. First of all, I just want to remind folks that if you were interested in some role-playing game scenarios by me, I will be running some game – or I'll be running a couple of games at Gen Con for the guys from Paradigm Concepts. This is a game company that has published Witch Hunter, Rotted Capes, Arcanus, and now they've got Cthulhu Strange Aeons, which is a Chaosium licensed Cthulhu game set in sort of a far future, possibly your tech level falls somewhere between Blade Runner, Aliens, somewhere in that range, plus the Mythos. And I'll be running a game called The Elder God Particle, which will be run on Friday and Saturday at 2:00 at the con. And I believe there'll be other games as well, but it's part of a tournament where I've supplied the scenario. And so if you can rush out and sign up for that on Gen Con's website, then you will get to die horribly in the future, as opposed to...
Is there any chance that it actually has seats available still?
I haven't the slightest idea.
In my experience,
Well, there's always no-shows. I mean, that's
That's true, and that's what I always wind up telling people is yes, all of our events were sold out within 30 seconds of the thing opening, thanks to pre-registration, but most of the time somebody can't make it, you know, and there's an open spot. And if, you know, so if you want to go, then it's first come, first serve if you have a generic ticket.
Right. Yeah. And with a title like, you know, Elder God Particle, you can just say that it's simultaneously sold out and there's spaces at the same time.
Right.
How very quantum of you.
Yes.
So that's going to go on. But the other thing that is desperately being hammered together with sledgehammers is the Kickstarter for Horrors of War. We're finally going to launch that this year. I'm aiming for July 28th launch because that is the day that Serbia was the, had it was war was declared against Serbia by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Since all these are World War One scenarios, I guess I should remind everyone who doesn't already know that Horrors of War, the first edition, is going to be all about World War One. Call of Cthulhu scenarios set against the backdrop of the Great War. The intention, of course, is to keep going and to do scenarios set, you know, Spanish-American War, the War of the Pacific, down in South America, the War of the Triple Alliance, the one that begs to be done is the War of Canudos, which is this insane war in Brazil at the end of the 19th century that involves an apocalyptic Christian cult that just about defeats the armies of the entire state of Brazil using what can only be described as crazed Cthulhu cultic human wave tactics of just, you know, religiously riled up folks with machetes pouring out of the forest to hack down Brazilian soldiers.
And that's before you start making it a Call of Cthulhu scenario.
Yeah, that's before you throw in the mythos. It's just crazy. The War of the Canudos is particularly shocking and weird. But, you know, we want to set it in things like, you know, do stuff in the Russian Civil War, maybe the Irish Civil War down in Mexico during that conflict. You know, trying to do a lot of stuff, but, that'll be close to the classic era. You know, either just before, at the cusp of the classic era, or through that period of time, so that, you know, many of these scenarios are one-offs, but the other idea is that they could be used as a genesis for why a group of players would know each other in civilian life, why they would trust each other on the subject of supernatural occurrences, and why they might come together to work together in that classic era. It's often been said that one of the weaknesses of the Call of Cthulhu setting is it does not have a campaign setting. It has a world that is Earth, you know, and it has the mythos, which is just an element like, I don't know, gravity, perhaps, or strong and weak nuclear forces. It's just part of that world. But except for things like Golden Dawn, Delta Green, there's not a sort of a setting, a campaign setting to get the players back into a new game, always get them a new mission, always get them replacement characters. But at least this is something that will, the idea would be, this would be the setting for a way to launch traditional Call of Cthulhu games, a group of dedicated investigators. Why do they know each other? Why are they in contact? Well, they have this experience together during the war, and it carries over to their civilian life. Either that or it's just awesome little one-offs where, you know, you can load up with all of your tools of war and go off and die horribly. In the past,
many wars ago.
Yeah, we'll get to the Italian front. Don't you worry. So right now, we'd like to launch it on the 28th. If I miss that date, I still get the August 1st, maybe an alternate launch date, because that's the day that the Germans declare war on Russia, turning what would have been another crappy Balkan war into a genuine global conflict. That's the moment where it really gets completely out of control. So we're going to be launching the Kickstarter. We're planning for a 60-day Kickstarter. And the basic idea is that the Kickstarter will fund a generalist book on scenarios for the Great War. The scenarios won't be specialized geographically or thematically, but later books will. Where the scenarios will be hooked into things like scenarios that take place in the far-flung reaches of these European empires, like in Africa or Asia or the Middle East, and or perhaps a book that will be very closely associated with the Western Front. That's the announcement. Look for it coming soon. We'll be handing out materials at Gen Con for people so that they can go right to the Kickstarter and start pledging. And Mr. Ivy was kind enough to let us put advertisement for Horrors of War in the newest edition of The Unspeakable Oath. So there.
Yeah.
And speaking of The Unspeakable Oath, Shane, what is in issue 24?
So 24 is out in PDF now, and it's at the printer. right now getting printed is probably what they do with it. And it looks pretty sweet. I'm really happy with how it came together. It has a scenario by Brett Kramer that we were complimenting earlier. Not a scenario, but a sort of a feature called the Cult of A, which is this modern day sort of supernatural look at the anorexia subculture.
Oh God, no.
Yeah. It's deeply, deeply disturbing.
The inspiration goes too far.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah. Oh, Ross.
That's a literal word they use. I've read about the pro anorexia movement. That's an actual thing.
Yeah.
What?
They use words like thinspiration.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty disturbing.
The world is so much worse than I imagined.
Oh no! Well, it's Scott. Go to get the PDF that I sent you and start on page 40, and it will be opened.
Does Brett go ahead and point out? Okay, this is what actual crazy people are doing, and this is what my fictional crazy people are doing.
Yeah, and I mean that's a fair point, because he and I had some back and forth about sort of how to frame this as a work of entertainment, right? Which is ultimately what we're doing. But not be totally oblivious to the fact that this is a really genuinely traumatic, painful thing for tons and tons of people. And so we tried to put enough of a disclaimer in there and kind of keep an eye on the tone and the tenor of the whole article, so that it took the right approach. And whether we succeeded at that, I guess is going to be up to the readers. But it's dreadful and amazingly good. Yeah, he did a good job with it. So and there's a haunted house adventure by Greg Stolze. That's a modern day haunted house that's really, really disturbing and cool. And Scott has an article about True Detective and relating some of its things to Delta Green campaigns.
Let's be honest, wanting to write about True Detective is really hard, because you don't want to reveal shit.
Right.
You don't want to tell anybody anything if they haven't seen it, because it happened to you.
Yeah.
You know, all of us had people just, you know, vomit out all these things on us at the first opportunity. I'm like, well, I don't have HBO, but let me tell you about it.
So, right.
Funny story, I don't have HBO, and I am waiting to be able to watch it.
Then I hope the article literally does not give anything away, but while simultaneously discussing it as an inspiration for a campaign setting.
I've been actually tabbing a lot of things as once I can watch True Detective, I will go back and check out all of these things.
Yeah.
I have that list, which I don't have for other things, but I do for True Detective.
Yeah, well, there's about 75 Rustin Cole parodies now available for you on YouTube if you want to watch Matthew McConaughey or people make fun of Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, I've seen the first couple episodes, so I would like I'm now at that weird point of like I know a couple things, but I can't look at anything because you know.
Yeah.
It's out on DVD. You have no excuse. Run out and buy it. It's at any price.
Oh, fantastic. Well, then I'm going to leave this podcast out right now.
Right. See you. I wouldn't blame you.
Sir, it's available. Ryan, you're here in Seattle. It's available at Scarecrow if it ever gets checked back in. They got about 9 sets that are always checked out and have been.
I don't think it will be checked back in anytime soon.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think you're going to have to go out and buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I even wrote a review of True Detective for the New Oath, in fact. So you were on the fence. And then we have there's the new Delta Green book, Tales from Failed Anatomies, is out in every format now except audiobook, and we've got audio stories in development by the people at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. But that's out in ebooks and PDF and paperback and hardback, Dennis's collection of Delta Green horror stories. and then I'm working on the editing the new collection that came as a spinoff from the Kickstarter that funded Failed Anatomies. What else? Elder Godlike is a sort of a mashup of our really, really brutal, gritty World War II superhero game Godlike with Call of Cthulhu through Octoon Cthulhu, which we'll talk about more in a little bit. And
I've actually run Elder Godlike too, because I'm running it at Gen Con, so I wanted to, you know, try it out once before I actually run it.
Oh yeah.
And playtest went well with the home group, the RPPR players. It's an interesting feel to have, because you still have the horrors of the mythos, but you also have just enough superpowers to really get yourself. And the rules synergize, because the more you use the superpowers make you more vulnerable to going insane in many ways.
Excellent.
Yeah. Which is... and even though the characters have superpowers or some sort of ability, they're still very vulnerable. Like, at one point, one of the characters, Aaron, players, his character almost died because
you,
he was trying
you
to
almost fly. Said Aaron, didn't you?
Yeah, well, Aaron was playing the character, the scientist with the ice ray gun, and he was climbing up the side of a frozen ship. He was falling. He failed his climb trick, so he fell off and was going to plummet into the Atlantic Ocean, which would have been bad. And so he's like, "Well, I'll just shoot the ocean and it'll turn into ice." And
you can hit it. You can hit the ice like it's concrete.
Exactly. That's what happened.
Because it's air.
Yeah, it was a highlight of the playtest session. It was a fun game, and so I'll be running that at again at Gen Con. If you there probably someone won't show up, so if you have tickets, you might show up. And if not, I'll post the actual play at some point.
Did he form the ice into stalactites so he could be impaled on it when he?
No, it was I had it as a little mini iceberg, so he just knocked himself out, and fortunately the other characters fished him out of the ocean before he died. But
didn't he know that the Iceman thing is to make it a slide, you know? So
yeah. Well, he just said he was going to shoot it down. He didn't do the Iceman thing.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
And that's how people die.
Yeah. Superpowers are dangerous, but anyway, so it's a fun game.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, as you said, the killer app for Elder Godlike is being a talent, you know, being somebody that's got some kind of a superpower means that you're a step closer than every other human being to all the horrible realities of the Cthulhu mythos. So
well, that's
it's
pretty cool.
It's a shortcut to going insane.
Excellent. And it's based on the Call of Cthulhu system. Like, it's a percentile base, and they've modified the godlike superpower creation system so that it runs in a percentile system instead of one roll engine. Yeah. So if you're used to Call of Cthulhu, it just takes a couple of changes to get used to. So it runs very smoothly.
It's been an interesting project. So that's in art and the last stages of editing now, and that'll go to Modiphius for layout and publication in just a couple of weeks. And let me speed through stuff because I'm taking way too long. But
we're gonna lose Ryan.
The Delta Green role playing game is in its core rules are in a sort of an alpha playtest right now with a select group of backers of the fiction Kickstarter that signed up for that. And so I'm really curious and kind of terrified to start getting feedback from people that are not, you know, me and Greg and Dennis on how those rules actually work. So we should be getting that soon. And then assuming all goes well enough, then I'm thinking I'm going to have a sort of a stripped down, you know, tape bound, almost beta version of the playable rules and a few scenarios that we can have available as a secret purchase at Gen Con, you know. But we'll probably have to do the spy's demise thing, you know, and have you have to know the password to be able to get at it. But so we'll see. We'll kind of make some kind of an announcement about that when I know for sure whether that's going to happen. And then Dennis has launched a Patreon account just today.
I think it's just pronounced patron.
Patron, is it patron? Yeah. Okay, but there's an E before the O. So
yeah, it's just because internet startups.
I guess patron makes a lot more sense than Patreon. I don't know what I was thinking. But,
I thought it was just pronounced tequila.
Don't tell the listeners that. That's not no, it's to support the arts. It's not to support your drinking habits. No, not at all. Give us money. Yeah.
So Dennis Detwiller has one running to facilitate him quote unquote writing more for Delta Green, and what he really does with that money, I guess we'll find out.
Well, this Dennis guy, has he done anything we should know about? I mean, why would we want to support, you know, this up and coming kid? Who is this guy? Has he proved himself yet? If only he had a track record.
Unfortunately, everyone who knew of his track record died of time radiation.
Yes, he did. That son of a bitch. No one's going to forgive him for that scenario.
Yes.
It's going to hang around his neck like Richard Widmark pushing the old lady down the stairs in the wheelchair.
I'm glad it exists. So we have the, like, here is the ultimate. Here's the. It's not quite Tomb of Horrors, but it's.
Well,
it's
Tomb of close. Horrors is far more baroque and clearly sadistic.
In Tomb of Horrors, you can choose to not put your hand in the black void of death.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like, you know, it's like turning up for Tomb of Horror and say, you arrive at the tomb, you die. What?
But we'll.
I'm sorry. You don't die, you just go back to the Pleistocene, enjoy the trilobites. You know, that's
So there's that. And then other things we have coming up, the Delta Green game will get its own Kickstarter project very soon. And we also have Kickstarters coming up and even more imminent for No Souls Left Behind, which is a campaign book for Better Angels, our supervillain role-playing game that, Ross, you've played extensively.
Yes, we have the full campaign up on RPPR Actual Play. It's basically a group of high school teachers, parents, or faculty members or students gain superpowers through demonic possession, and they decide to use their powers to save the school from, you know, being defunded. It's a charter school, and so it's like playing through a school year trying to be a normal person to fit in and then committing super crimes in order to protect the school and save the city. So it's for the kids has been the... So committing atrocities for the sake of better education. It was a really fun campaign to play through. Caleb also combines like a little bit like The Wire season 4, just the sheer corruption and incompetence of school bureaucracies and government and corporate bureaucracies and that kind of thing. So it's,
you know, did you have anyone who's actually, did anyone contribute to this or take a look at this that was an actual teacher? Because I can
Caleb was an actual teacher.
Oh, so see, that's terrifying, right?
Yeah. It was very cathartic for him to write this.
Well, that was like, that's like Stolze writing, what was it, Cult of Transcendence, after having worked as a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that was the inspiration for Cult of Transcendence.
So it's working on the materials for the Kickstarter right now. It's going to be, it's an incredible, I mean, if you listen to the actual play, the people, the listeners have loved it. And if you, even if you're not sold on Better Angels, it's going to be a very unique campaign. It'll be pretty easily adaptable to any kind of superhero themed around a high school kind of setting, which, I mean, that's actually kind of a popular trope, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, the Spider-Man kind of thing.
Yeah, and in the Kickstarter, I'm probably going to set it up to have sort of stretch goals for converting and adapting easily over to other systems as well.
It's going to be great. Yeah. So,
And then let's see, we'll have, I'm working with John Scott Tynes about, with a new edition of Puppet Land, his mid 90s, really weird and very cool role playing game.
Giant slice of awful. Let's just, there's so much awful and terrible and dreadful.
But in a good way.
Insofar as that it is excellently crafted awful. Right. I mean, that's, you know, it's just going to make you cry.
And so we're it's always been available sort of just as text or as a very kind of very spare paperback edition. And so we're going to be putting together a Kickstarter to do a nice hardback storybook edition with full color art, you know, and really pretty full color art at that, and make it very, very, very shiny. So that's coming together. And then we have other stuff coming up that's going to be later on or next year. I'm talking to Ray Wininger about possibly doing a new edition of Underground, his 1990s.
Oh, I'm so glad that Ray found a home for that
game from Mayfair. And then
do you think it's fair to call it a superhero game?
It is
the single most horrifying dystopian version of America I have ever seen in fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, so exactly. And so you can buy superpowers and be sort of horrible psychopathic mercenaries, but with superpowers.
Yeah, and you can get them from vending machines. I mean, that's what superpowers are. You can get them from fucking vending machines. And they work about as well as you'd expect a superpower you bought from a vending machine.
Exactly. So Ray and I are and Dennis are talking that over right now to see if we what we need to do to bring that together. And then I'm talking with James Houghton and Dave Farnell and a couple of other fellows about a very cool book idea they had about the King in Yellow that we may bring together as well. So, but we'll have more about those as we go along. So be on the lookout for Delta Green in the very near future. All right, so that's it for me. So let's get Ross. You say what you're up to, and Ryan, let's hear from you as well at long.
I'll try to make this fast. Like I said, I'm running scenarios at Gen Con, and I've got three. I've got Elder Godlike, Kerberos Club, and one of Base Raiders, which is a game of my own creation using the Strange Fate system, first introduced in Kerberos Club Fate Edition, and Base Raiders
is the version of Kerberos that you're running at Gen Con.
Yes. Cool. Yeah, I'm running Kerberos Fate Edition at Gen Con and Base Raiders, so I wouldn't have to change. I wouldn't have to bring multiple sets of dice. I'm that lazy. And so Base Raiders is again superheroes meets dungeon crawling through the Bat Cave or the Fortress of Solitude. And so I've had a new writer, a guy named Peter Nielsen, who's a listener of RPPR, send me a scenario, and I liked it, so I'm going to get a Kickstarter up at some point for Boiling Point, which is a full scenario set in an underwater base, so high-tech pirate ships, shark men, aliens, and all kinds of part investigation, part dungeon crawling. You got to find the base, then you have to get in, get the loot, and get out, and possibly save the world. That's coming
up. If it pays well enough.
If it pays well enough, well, you know, an invasion of alien shark guys isn't good for business. So, you know, probably have to do something about that.
Wake me when they get to Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. So in also in other news with Arc Dream, I have started posting the actual plays of the Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man, the Call of Cthulhu Dreamlands campaign that Arc Dream has put out. So we're going to post episode 3. Episode 3 will be up by the time this podcast gets up, so you can listen on and see how Dennis Detwiller's interpretation of the Dreamlands through my running of the game pans out. Not well for the player characters. Although it's kind of funny, Caleb played a character who is basically, for most of the campaign, denied that he was in the Dreamlands. He's like, this is a weird dream I'm having. I wonder what that monster symbolizes. Something in my subconscious? Oh, okay, you know. And, oh, you guys are all just figments of my imagination.
Right.
It was pretty entertaining. So
yeah, one of my
that's
players took that approach for the campaign as well. Yeah.
He kept making those sand checks, so up until the end. So anyway,
sometimes a gug is just a gug.
So Ryan, I know you.
We're quoting that, Shane. That's going to be a fucking internet meme before the day's over with. Sometimes a gug is just a gug.
Yeah, I can see that being an image macro with a big picture of a gug. Like, really? Anyway. So, Ryan, I know you had...
And first of all, Ryan, tell our listeners, now that we've spent like 5 hours talking about ourselves, let's tell our listeners, you know, a little bit about your background and and what you're up to right now as well.
Hello, your heart.
So I'm Ryan Macklin. I am one of those people who thought it would be a good idea to quit a lucrative job and become a creative full time. So I apologize to future self for that idea.
Yeah.
I'm a game designer. I'm known for working on the Dresden Files role playing game. I'm one of the co-creators of Fate Core, a bunch of other various Fate related stuff. I've done some stuff for other companies, did the Technocracy books for Onyx Path for Mage the Ascension. I'm an editor at Paizo Publishing, and I do my own stuff all the time, too. Like, most notably, my game about stabbing Odin and his good eye because it's there, called Mythender.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically float around because people sometimes like to give me money, and I think that's great.
In a manly way. In a manly way.
however people pay for, that's what I'll do. I'm a freelancer. So... And right now I'm with Tim Rodriguez of Brooklyn Indie Games doing a Kickstarter for a thing called Backstory Cards, which is a character collaborative character background generator, where you take characters that you assume would know each other because of the conceit of the game, some setting elements, and blend them together, and you have this like intricate history and things that are moving about in the world right now, so you can sort of jump into a little bit better than like, hey, you guys know each other from college and just met up again recently. Now go and visit, this one guy's creepy uncle who just died and left you, a fortune, or you guys met in a tavern or stuff like that. So I've got that going on right now, and that ends, the Kickstarter ends July 18th, and we just greenlit the horror expansion for that, which includes some prompts specifically for investigation or horror or investigative horror games. And I'll have a Trail of Cthulhu demo probably by the time this launches. And you can find that at backstorycards.com.
That's very cool. So it sounds like the whole point of the cards is to make them fairly system neutral. Is that right?
It is. Like, there are definitely rules because I'm, involved in the Fate community, and Fate kind of has a setup like this.
Right.
It does have rules for replacing the parts where you guest star in each other's adventures or stories with the system. But we've used it in a couple different Fate games. My partner Tim Rodriguez used it for Dungeon World and put that online. I've used this for Trail. I've heard people talking about using this to just create like NPC write-ups for their LARPs. Somebody wants to use this just to like help them figure out how his characters are, interact in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is just, here's a bunch of prompts and a way to turn these Mad Libs into something. Like, you might get like, you PC and NPC were in a love triangle and you were worse for the wear. And you have a way of generating which are the PCs and which are the individuals. You answer some questions that might lead to other questions you answer or ask right then. So, and with prompts like that, it interconnects the characters together in various ways, either cooperative or adversarial or just dramatic, to each other and to setting elements, individuals, groups, events, and places. And that's sort of what it's designed to do.
I guess what I was wondering is that kind of how flexible is that with genre? In other words, it looks like from the description you've got, it can apply really easy to a lot of sort of adventure gaming things. Did it require you're going to do something for Trail? So did it require any twisting to make it fit a sort of supernatural horror investigative game versus a more standard adventure-y game?
So the first time I used it was actually for a supernatural horror, but a horror trope, Hellboy-ish kind of game, as opposed to like, lower level, grittier thing. I made it to where it's about relationships with people and the world. Mm. And those relationships can kind of, you can sort of layer that onto supers or, transhumanist sci-fi or, or fantasy or whatnot. But there are certainly some of the expansions we're doing have very pointed prompts that are specifically about touching on a genre or set of tropes too.
Right.
And mixing those together, the Trail demo, which will be on the Kickstarter page, tomorrow, as far as the point of time of we're recording this. Actually, as the first round of it, I use the regular prompts. And then for the second round, like once we have like we're people who have regular screwed up relationships, regular interesting relationships. Now let's deal with the horror cards. And that ended up a layer of things that were, you know, happening to us. But we could have just easily not used the horror cards and said we are people who have all these sort of ties together. Now we're in a horrific situation. In fact, I think that would be what you'd want to do if you were to suddenly throw people into a survival horror game, is that where the horror is being revealed from like moment one, as opposed to has been revealed in the past for these characters.
Yeah. Very cool. So that's and that's wrapping just at the end of the week. Is that right?
Yep. At like 8 p.m. my time, which is Pacific time on July 18th, is when it's out, and it's like $8 to get all the print and play stuff. It's $15 to get a deck.
Yeah, and that's fully funded at this point, right?
Like, oh yeah,
and then some. So
yeah, we're doing pretty well. Just want people to like. You always get that thing where somebody's like, "Why did no one tell me about this Kickstarter?" Yep. Like the day at like the minute it ends, we're like,
"Oh yeah,
we did what we could." So I've got that. I worked on the Octane Cthulhu Fate Edition, and that's out now in PDF and soon in print. I don't know when, but Chris Birch knows when, and he is on the internet. So that's the Fate Edition, which involves me spending a long time trying to create, and I think it did pretty well, so trying is perhaps self-denigrating, creating rules for a Fate game that could do a pretty good thing of like a Band of Brothers-esque style of game. Mm-hmm. And also the horrific sense of like the continual sanity onslaught of the mythos. Mm-hmm. While still feeling like a Fate game.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that too is that I was talking with Chris early on in the project, and I said, you know, one of the things I'd really like to do is to make sure that we support the Fate community by making sure that the rules for it are open in the Creative Commons space. And he said that was, you know, love that idea. And so I want people who think that it's a cool idea to support him by getting it. And then, you know, it's stuff that is now out there. The sanity rules now are things that people can use and stuff like that. So yeah. I hope that people enjoy it and love it. And I've heard people so far, like, responding pretty positively to it.
Yeah, good deal. Good deal. And that's with Modiphius, or if you look for Octane Cthulhu, that may be even easier to spell for some reason.
Yeah, and then...
So- sorry, I do have to bring this up because you're talking about doing Fate rules conversions. I'm just out of personal curiosity. You are working on the Eclipse Phase Fate conversion rules, right?
I am.
And would you care to have any updates on that?
My update is what it always is when I'm working on somebody else's publisher stuff, which is you should follow the publisher to learn about updates.
All right.
It's almost as if I know how to do this job for a living.
Right.
Follow. I mean, if you are on the Kickstarter or if you follow the social media or stuff like that, you will see what's going on. There are Gen Con plans, and that's as much as I can say.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, people frequently like will ask me on Twitter and stuff like that, and you know, like Adam or Spider, somebody will like, you know, jump in and say like, here's where we are now. So, but yeah, I'm super excited about that one. That one is hard. That one is even harder to do than like figuring out how to do sanity and Fate and not feel like not Fate. It's awesome, but it's hard.
I'm really curious now. What's sort of one thing that makes it that difficult for that?
The morph sleep, morph ego thing.
Fate is not very great with equipment. You can use equipment, you can play with equipment, but when it comes to equipment and Fate, it is the thing that. Fate doesn't care about. It's not that it doesn't work. It's that Fate doesn't care about it. You can, and the more you try to make Fate care about it, the more you break elements of the economy because it's so tight. Mm. But the unfortunate thing is that morphs are equipment and character agency and character identity all wrapped into one.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that you can switch morphs, I mean, I could go on for like hours, but I won't. But let's just say morphs. I've got a pretty good solution right now, and we'll see, you know, what playtesters think about it once we get out there. But morphs are hard. that's part of why I took the job, because I don't like taking easy conversions.
Cool.
All right.
Cool. And also, I want to say that so my birthday is coming up. It is July 22nd, and the thing that I would like people to do on the internet, whether they know me or not, is to perhaps sometime that week talk about a recent play experience that they loved, and just to talk about how games, you know, make their lives better. That's all. That's all I would want.
Yeah, good deal.
Talk about a recent play experience. All right, yeah. I don't think I can go a week without talking about that.
You're already passively celebrating my birthday.
Yes. You're welcome. All right.
All right. Well, happy upcoming birthday, Ryan.
Thank you.
Yes. So now we can get to the actual topic at hand, player agency and horror.
Hooray, topic!
So normal traditional horror games like Call of Cthulhu and Deltagreen have a player GM relationship straight out of the, you know, old school D&D. You know, the GM is the authority, absolute and exclusive control over everything except the action of the player characters. And thanks to the sanity rule, sometimes the GM controls those characters too. But of course, in the last decade or so, there's sort of been more of a movement towards, you would call it the story game movement of RPGs, of games reacting against the DM as God, the GM as God, by sharing narrative authority among the players. So you can take for example, Trail of Cthulhu, where the player has control, like, no, I can get that clue. I will always get that clue because I can make a spend with my investigative skill point. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Then, of course, even more so in the Apocalypse World style of like Tremulous, where characters have a lot more agency than they do in Call of Cthulhu. And then there are Fate, Realms of Shadow, I think. Is that the Savage World one?
Realm of Shadows and Cthulhu Dark are sort of other spins on Call of Cthulhu that are very, very different in their approach. But I don't really think they're in the same category as Tremulous or even Trail with Realms it uses
Cthulhu Dark. I would definitely put the most story game of the most, because the players, you literally cannot die unless you want to. I think it's been a while.
Well, it certainly sounds horrifying.
Well, yeah. If you choose, you know, if you fight the monster, you die, right?
Yeah, but that's
generally
it.
It's kind of on the players to sort of. It's rare for the it discourages, if I remember right, it discourages the game master from forcing that on the players, because the approach for Cthulhu Dark is not to get the player characters dead, but to get the players kind of, you know, trembling and scared.
Now I'm looking at the rules again. The way it works is you don't fail skill checks unless someone else, another person, thinks it would be more interesting if you do fail, then describes how you might fail and roll a die. Then whoever rolls higher wins. So if you if you're escaping from the window of the Innsmouth Hotel on a roll of a 1 on a D6, you crash on an adjoining roof, attracting the attention of everyone around. On a 6, you escape quietly. So even on a 1, you escape, just not very well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's more. So you can't outright fail unless the player says, no, I think you would just trip and get caught. And then you would roll off to see who.
And now we have some drama around your capture and your imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and then of course, Ryan, you were developing, as we just said, you were developing a sort of a Fate look at Acton Cthulhu, which is Acton Cthulhu by its ordinarily sort of the default is a Call of Cthulhu campaign set in World War II, kind of by way of Hellboy, and it's a little more pulpy and comic booky than sort of traditional standard Call of Cthulhu, and so the Fate adaptation for that. I guess that may be a good starting point, you know, for us here is what challenges did you face in presenting Acton Cthulhu through Fate in a way that, you know, maximized that sense of suspense, or was that really the prior, was that the way to think about the priority?
Well, so years ago, I wrote about how Fate can't really do horror. And then shortly after that, Chris Birch contacted me about doing Acton Cthulhu. And I figured, well, I'm happy to eat my words and actually prove myself wrong, because I will actually spend a lot of time working to make it work, as opposed to, you know, somebody else possibly just trying to graft on stuff. Mm. And I had a really in-depth understanding of it. And the reason that the two-fold elements that make fate difficult for horror is that, one, after it's sort of a lizard brain element, where after you roll the dice, instead of immediately dealing with the consequences at hand, yeah, you can pause and think about what you want to do, whether or not you want to get some spend some fate points, invoke some aspects and things like that. You have the weird sense where you can choose how much you fail. You can have a sense of – you can just simply pause and think about it, and that disrupts a lot of tension because there's not dread that goes into, like, what's going to happen, and immediately I will suffer the consequences for it, which I think is one of the things that I love about the Apocalypse World engine, is that there isn't that beat there that can – shift you from dread to analysis. Mm. You go right from dread to consequences. Mm-hmm. So that's one part. The other part is that with the exception of really major hits in fate, as far as like physical or mental assault or whatnot, they more or less go away after, you know, after a scene or so. So it's only like the major things that happen that can really impact your character for a long period. So you don't have the fear that happens when you have a death by a thousand cuts that you get in other things. And so those two things together make it hard to make horror sell in fate, particularly on the lower end, like survival horror. Like, you can certainly do urban fantasy that is horrific, which we did in the Dresden Files, but doing something of lower scale is not easy. And the solution I took with when I was building the sanity system for Octun Cthulhu is that while you are more sane, when you have a sanity trigger happen, and instead of each monster having its own sanity rating, I just have the idea of sanity triggers in fate. This happens, you know, they roll for sanity. That sort of tells like about how much further agency they have and whether or not they're sort of on a sliding scale towards becoming insane. You get this thing where if you're sane and you're confronted with something horrific, there's a bunch of situations where you can't invoke aspects.
Right. Okay.
You're actually the very thing that gives you agency in horror. You have it in every other time, except when suddenly you see the dead rise for the first time. You can use it to escape. You can't use it to confront or things like that. And then the more insane you become, the easier it is to use all of those aspects you have, because you're suddenly becoming used to the world, but also you have all these detriments of, well, you're going insane and not being the same sort of person that everyone else is. And so building that took like four different revisions of rules. And actually does have the death by a thousand, well, the death by like 30 cuts, but the death that actually does keep track, as opposed to stress and fate that goes away after you take a moment to breathe, or, you know, or mild consequences that go away a scene after you treat it and stuff like that. So this is, it's persistence. It's long. I wrote a little bit in the sanity chapter of like, it takes weeks to recover one of these things. The reason it takes weeks is because you're going to wish you had more time than you're going to have, because like, oh, I'll take R&R for 4 weeks, like 2 weeks into it, you have another mission that you'd have to do. So that way there's that sense of like we have this thing, how you can totally recover, but the world is hellish on you and will not let you recover.
Yeah.
Unless you like intentionally say like, nope, my guy checks out. That's the nature of my story, is that now he's just going to be in an asylum for a year. I'll make a new character. And that's kind of a cool story too, where you talk about somebody just checking out because they can't handle it.
Right. Right.
And so that was the challenge, was to make it feel, I get to rely on the fact that Octun Cthulhu is pulpy, but it doesn't change how the sanity system works. It's just, you know, like the action is pulpy, but the heroes are not necessarily super inert to the mythos. And so that was the trick, was like actually representing the horror and the mythos sense of magic in fate. And that was a lot of fun, but it actually took quite a bit of work. That was like, I think, for draft 4, more or less, is what you see in the final product.
Right. So when you in that Fate version then, or that Fate adaptation, then if you're, you know, your character is exposed to something horribly traumatic, right? So do you pick, is it like you pick up an aspect that says, you know, I've got, I don't know, some kind of phobia or some kind of something?
If you hit a certain threshold, you can start. If you hit a certain threshold, you can start kind of coming up with like what conditions or situations you're in. And you'd be like, but it's very, it's not like a constant aspect generator, like a lot of other things in Fate, because that's creatively taxing. So it's in moments where you can sort of state, I think I now know what an aspect would be from this moment. But it's not inherently just a continual aspect generator. I find that those systems end up being really hard. Like, many Fate designers, particularly folks who are new to Fate, will create systems that generate lots and lots and lots of aspects, not recognizing that in play, it is difficult to keep up and keep making interesting ones.
Right.
So that's one of the elements in this, is that there's a chart that you're tracking down, and when you hit certain thresholds, you're assigned a new static. Thing like you're now disturbed as opposed to of sound mind. So now this sort of aspect lingers on your character. It can be, you can be compelled, you know, it can kind of frame the story. And maybe we'll write a few things about what that aspect means specifically to you. Like, I'm disturbed. And when we've taken a little bit of time, you know, in between sessions, I think I have a phobia because this happened like around a door. I think I just have an unnatural phobia of open doors. You know, and like, okay, cool, we'll write that in, but that's what disturbed means, as opposed to trying to invent a bunch of aspects and flowery language and stuff like that.
Right. So how well do you feel like all of that process worked toward addressing the concerns that you had way back when?
Well, so I think that if I wanted to run pure survival horror, I would still not use Fate. But this is a thing that lets me play with that sort of like very, very much that horror amidst action. And that was, I'm fairly satisfied with it. I think it's the sort of thing like with any game where, like, you know, and I'll play it a year from now and I'll still tinker with something.
Sure.
But I mean, that's just what we do. Yeah. But I don't feel like that tinkering isn't because it's bad. It's just because I will keep thinking about it and running it through my mind.
Yeah.
The first couple iterations I had of it had the same sort of thing of like, you know, denying when you're able to use aspects, and people hated it because of how strong that denial was. So I softened it a little bit. I had to make it feel a little bit more like Fate, as opposed to feeling like, oh, this is the time when we're not playing Fate anymore, but we're rolling fudge dice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of stuff where I had really great ideas that turned out to suck. And so I blended.
That never happens to Shane or Ross or I.
Right, exactly. And so I blended the not sucky parts of that into something else. And then that sucked. I did that two more times, and I came up with what I got. But yeah, I'm fairly happy with it. I think the only thing I might tweak is like the math over time to represent different like lengths of play and stuff like that. But the methodology, I'm pretty happy with, especially because it is like there's a quick reference page that is. When something horrible happens to someone's mind, here are the questions for the GM to quickly assess so that you know how bad it is.
Right.
That way it's just like, that way it can, you know, you don't have to look up a monster stat, because in Fate, you'll end up sometimes. I mean, I actually, in spite of statting up all the monsters in Octane Cthulhu, I much prefer to play my mythos-oriented games with things that, you know, aren't actually from the books.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that even like having like the sort of player knowledge of, you know, being versed in like, you know, Lovecraftia and things like that, mm-hmm. Can make things like, even that is in a sense player agency. Oh, so I will throw a lot of that out the window. And so I have all these monsters, like, great, which means I made stats for stuff, which means I can remix them at will. And it's just going to be horrifying. It's sort of I very much like to run very loose with Fate. So
Hold on just a second, fellas, because there's something that Ryan brought up here that I kind of want to touch on.
Okay.
Because he mentioned sort of that, I guess it's the topic of metagaming of player knowledge versus character knowledge. And is that something that, you know, and he sort of connected it to player agency. I kind of wanted to go back on the topic a little bit and see if we can get a definition from the Peanut Gallery here on what we really think we're talking about when we say player agency, because I believe this term has changed over time to mean different things.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. But when I think about it, I think in terms of the amount of control that the players around the table, as opposed to the game master or the keeper or whatever, have over the course of the story, beyond just my character says this, my character tries to do this, right? And so that's how I think about it. I mean, what does everybody else think?
Well, for me, it is that in the sense that it's not controlling what your character does per se, but controlling the flow of the narrative. Mm. By saying, for example, in a Call of Cthulhu game, like my character wants to have a contact who knows about old occult books, and the GM just says no, but it's not a skill. No. But in, say, Knight's Black Agent, you could just say, I spend 3 points of my contacts pool, and now I have an old book dealer who I can go to and ask questions about this book I found. And the GM, that's explicitly the player can say that there's something that it's control of the game outside of the character's action. So it's like saying, like, to prepare, like that, or the preparedness pool, where the character says, yeah, I can have a flashlight. I didn't explicitly say I had a flashlight earlier on, but it would be reasonable for me to have a flashlight. So I make my roll, I spend my points, and now I have a flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's how I view it. I mean, there's the other thing of railroading, like, can players actually have multiple choices? Do they have valid choices? Like, or is it linear path?
The idea that the first idea I'm thinking of when I think of, you know, the earliest idea of player agency was just that the players, the players and sort of the characters have an option, have the ability to alter the events, that they have the ability to make choices. In the game, whatever it is, and, you know, as opposed to you kick door, kill thing, take stuff, you know, mm-hmm. sort of is the nadir of player agency. Mm-hmm. There's nothing except, you know, reacting to this linear sort of presentation of set pieces.
Yeah,
not even
feels like two different issues, right? To me, I mean, that feels like, in fact, what you're talking about there is more like how much authority do the characters have?
So that's the thing that I look at here. There's a difference between player agency and character agency.
Mm-hmm.
And for horror games, I think the player agency is the part that can diffuse, if you're looking for tension as opposed to playing with tropes, that's what can really diffuse the vibe at a horror table.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So let's give some examples of what we're talking about here. In Ross, you just gave a few for Knights of Black Agents, and there are some similar things in Trail of Cthulhu.
Well, I could also talk about the railroading thing. So, like, last night I actually ran a Trail of Cthulhu game, Shanghai Bullets, for a group of new players, and they weren't. And so I would give them choices, like, in the sense, like, okay, you could go to the nightclub to investigate that. You could go to the mission hospital to talk about the death of this murdered French priest. You could talk to the people he knew. You could do this or that or this. And I tried to give sort of explicit options, because otherwise these players, they were new to, like, investigating mysteries. And so they weren't, you know, as active as some other players I've had in my group. That's kind of a concern for me. Like, if I make these choices, am I necessarily, like, cutting them off from deciding, you know, option C, which is, like, let's go beat up some hobos and hit the streets and maybe they'll know something about the death of this murdered priest, and or, you know, whatever. And So, like, and even towards the end, like,
depending
when the
on your time and place, that might be an appropriate police procedure.
Well, it was the 20s, so yeah.
Yeah.
It was totally appropriate. But the, and towards the end, the players were trying to trick a bad guy, and I actually gave them a plan, like, that they like, okay, you just do a sleight of hand thing and make the bad guy think you dropped the object into the ocean instead of holding, you know, sneaking it away, and, or you threw it into the ocean. So that was. And I was kind of wondering myself whether I was giving them agency or not.
Well,
because
some of this is a yeah. pull between abstract and concrete sort of gaming.
Yeah.
I find that the idea that you can just say, well, I spend my I spend one of my points in there in my preparedness point, so of course I have a flashlight, you know, to be kind of an abstract as opposed to the guy who wrote down all of his gear that he was bringing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, ticked off the ones that he was going to bring with him down into the mine shaft. You know, that's far more concrete. The question, the idea that it's a violation of player agency to say, you know, well, you didn't tell me you're bringing the flashlight. You didn't tell me you're bringing anything. Certainly the keeper or the GM needs to tell his players, you know, if that's the kind of game they're in. And if you fail to communicate to your players that, look, this is survival horror. If it turns out you need, you know, that clothespin and you didn't bring it, then, you know, that's on you. You need to tell me. And, of course, that results in guys saying, I bring the equipment list. Which one? The one from the book. I bring everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, essentially,
you can't get around that kind of bad gaming. People are going to try that. You just have to sort of educate them. You know, during your game of what is, you know, what's going to be acceptable, what's going to work in that situation. But you certainly can't spring that sort of concrete requirement on them without telling them first.
Well, that's kind of one of the rules of the game, in effect, right? If knowing to write down exactly what equipment you have is a skill that you have to bring to the table. It's knowing how to play the game, and if you don't know to do that, then you're not playing with the full game rules.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of different issues going on here. You know, like we said, one of them is the more big picture look at how much authority do the players have over the game world and over the shape of a scenario, you know, and then more drilled down, I think how much license do they have in order in their character's decision making. And if you're in if you're in a very kind of linear adventure, then even the characters themselves don't have much to contribute. And that's sort of your worst case scenario all around, where the players just feel like they're completely passengers.
Well, and, so I think that there's a place where I diverge a little bit, maybe, okay. or maybe we internet agree.
I can't even tell if we've got anything to diverge from yet. All over the map.
Well, then I will go further afield. Yay. So I sort of see player agency as anything that makes the players as opposed to the characters also feel safe.
Mm.
Where any sort of mechanism that allows for a release valve of tension to a degree, there's different sorts. The part that's important for the purposes of talking about it for a horror game is those forms of agency. And things like the preparedness skill, as opposed to having, you know, an equipment list that is, you know, effectively a sense of currency in the world. You know, it is, I have these things I can spend or use at some point. And I'm the sort of guy who hates equipment lists. I mean, I'm kind of well suited for having worked on Fate, because equipment lists and shopping is not my thing. But it's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, this is, yes, you know, there are ways in which you can have the thing that suddenly you realize you need. Maybe that's not a survival horror game. That certainly feels like it would work in
Isn't survival horror all about trying to make do with shit you wish
exactly.
you had?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And I think that the idea of stuff as currency is very key to a survival horror game, whereas investigative horror. And, I mean, there's, you know, where you can have investigative survival horror as, like, a Venn diagram and everything. But, like, when you're investigating something, information is a lot in a lot of ways that currency, where if you're given opportunities to invent information about the world, that's, you know, like, you know, maybe instead of the trail way of like spending something, you like, you know, fate, you know, create an advantage, and you know this advantage about this house because you have a really good, you know, history role or something like that. That's also a form of play agency, is being able to inject knowledge or get knowledge on demand.
But are we talking about inventing knowledge, or are we talking about discovering things, or
I mean, certainly in Fate, both of those happen.
Now, that's fun. You know, again, that's fine. But when I think of, you know, Call of Cthulhu, the idea that I just remember listening to a podcasted game where someone took a librarian and kept introducing themselves as, you know, a member of the League of Extraordinary Librarians. You know, as if this meant something, as if sometime like the 90th time they said it, the game master was going to go, yes, and your contacts with the league get you this, that, and the other. You know, there is no league. He's just saying these words. You know what I mean? It's like, and the idea that a player could, I don't know, have the kind of agency where they could add something to the storyline.
Right.
That's not there. Like, you know, I'm trying to come up with an example. My cousin who's in the mafia, you know, will now lend us a bushel of psychotic gunmen to soak up all the damage for us in this next, you know, encounter. It's like, well, what, you know, what do you mean? What cousin who's in the mafia? Well, the one I just, you know, thought of.
Well, and
or the one that it's in my character background or something.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue. There are a lot of games where that has a role, you know, where the game explicitly allows and encourages the player to insert
some kind of advantage
into the fiction.
Yeah.
Right? Insert a new part of a new thing into the story that the other players can.
Shane, you mentioned the idea of somebody going, well, I want to go contact my expert on the Cthulhu mythos, which again is kind of a shocking thing to suggest, but all right, let's yeah. Or did you say an antiquarian or something?
Yeah, well, I know him.
I know Henry Armitage, don't I?
Yeah.
I know Henry Armitage, don't I? It makes me want to punch the player in the face, but saying, do I have, as an academic, do I have contacts, say, with someone who could bring me up to speed on this piece of history or, this piece of occult nonsense, do I have dubious historical history, you know, department contacts, perhaps who delve into, I don't know, what you'd call conspiracy history or occult history or any of that kind of dubious crypto history, I guess you'd call it. Mm-hmm. You know, a GM just going, no, you don't, because your character exists completely in a vacuum and didn't exist until 15 minutes ago when you rolled it up, and doesn't have a 40-year history of life with a 35-year, you know, with a 25-year history of academia. Nope, you don't know anybody like that. Moving on. That's just bad GMing.
Right.
I just don't know how you're going to – that's just bad player behavior inflexible.
That's the other side of the coin is you know, one reaction to that is to play a game where the rules address that specifically by, you know, explicitly giving the players some kind of a license, even if it's a limited license in terms of you have to spend points that you only have a few of, to make those assertions and make them real within the game. And it tells the game master up front, you know, that if a player spends this point in order to make this assertion, then you're responsible for acknowledging it and making it real and agreeing with it. I mean, that's one approach to that. I mean, the other approach is more hands-off, where you're just relying on the game master and telling the game master, don't be a dick about this.
Well, and one of the things that really gets nebulous, especially when you're playing with people you don't know, like at a con or something like that, is that it's not necessarily bad player behavior to try to see where the boundaries are when they're not clearly communicated, because, you know, you just met somebody 5 minutes ago, you're kind of getting into it, you don't know what kind of GM they are, they don't know what kind of person you are. So, you know, for one person, like, I know Henry Armitage, don't I? You know, one GM, like, that sounds like a horrible idea. Yes, you do. You know, and I'm like that guy who's like, yes, give me more horrible ideas.
Right.
Yeah. Well, certainly, when they go and you want to consult, I want to go consult the, you know, the expert on the mythos. You know, right. It turns out he's a cultist.
Right.
You know an expert on it. You just didn't know he was a cultist.
And for me, I was going to go guy in the insane asylum. Yeah, good luck getting to him. But, you know, I love Fringe, which is why I immediately jumped to that.
I promise not to hold it against you that you love Fringe.
That's all right. Me and Fringe can enjoy a nice hotel room together. Yes. We don't need anyone's approval. But I also see that as true for even just knowing information, being able to declare information, not declaring tools or people in the world or whatnot, but even being able to say, as an expert on the classics, I see this thing and I will just tell you that I happen to know about this. This is not in my notes. And, you know, some games like, okay, we'll roll with that. And in some games, it is verboten.
Certainly when it comes to Call of Cthulhu skill lists, you know, we have certain sort of house presumptions that certain skill levels are such that you just don't have to roll anymore. If you have 40% in a language, you can communicate in that language. You're heavily accented. You know, you're not going to pass for a local, but you can communicate on almost any subject. History skills, medicine skills, first aid skills, certain levels of the skill just are not going to require a role in non-crisis situations.
Well, and I'm not talking about getting information, but about the newer wave element, like in Fate and other games that do, where you can simply declare that you know information that didn't exist already in the scenario or whatnot. You know, you're inventing information in there. And that's
give me an example of how you would do that, because I
spend a fate point. I know a bookie who knows the game.
Well, and that's a tool. That's not information. Yeah. That's a tool.
Let's talk about actually inventing information.
You know, I'm trying to, like, I had one of these at one point that was very weird. This was when the early days of trying to run an older force.
Because on the top, it sounds like, you know, my first thought is, it sounds like, you know, we're doing a vampire scenario. I'm going to spend a point to know that vampires don't exist. Scenario over, there are no vampires.
Well, no, I mean, clearly nothing like that. Like, this happens actually a lot in like pulp games and where some people will then translate it into other genres, where someone will just state like, yeah, no, and there's some glyphs on the wall and like, yes. And I know those glyphs are Atlantean and like, okay, those glyphs are Atlantean. And sort of like being able to declare by doing that, you're declaring also a sense of you're an authority on this. And there's a place where that hence a weird, that's like, that very much says as a pulp character, I am awesome. Look at how awesome I am. And, you know, maybe I'll make a roll to prove that I know this or whatnot.
The game master is inventing a game where it requires you to translate these Sumerian characters because the thing is about some, we're going to get around to Marduk and the Book of Life or whatever, and the character decides, nope, this game is about Atlantis. And
in Fate, and I think it's something that's like filling in a area blank, you know, if it was a map, it would be here be monsters, and then you say like it's this type of monster, you know, it's not contradicting previously established information,
but this is just
creating new information that is consistent with the whole
contradicting yet to be established information, because again, help the Grognard, who seems to who's still laboring under the misapprehension that the Keeper is the director and the writer. At least he wrote everything except the protagonist.
Yeah, well, that's really what I was hoping to kind of get to, is the pros and cons of alternatives to that approach. You know, in a horror game, especially something like Call of Cthulhu, which is usually presented as a fairly stark horror game where half the fun is in the abject, pathetic helplessness and humiliation of the player characters, you know, is there room for even reaching beyond the GM is God mentality?
Well, I think the key is that these resources should be used. They cannot trivialize the horror, the challenge of the scenario, but they're used so that the players do not, I guess I would call it, flounder before they get to the meat of the scenario. Because, I mean, if you go back to like Gumshoe, it was created so that players would not, you know, who fail their spot hidden checks would miss the scenario entirely, or they go off chasing Charlie Chaplin for, you know, a scenario.
Because that never happens. That never happens to Philip Marlowe. It doesn't happen to Philip Marlowe.
Yeah. So it's something, the idea is, the key is creating, giving the players access to a part of the narrative that allows them to get into the danger, but it does not allow them to defeat the danger, or to maybe help interpret the danger, but not to overcome it. So there's sort of a fine line between saying, I declare that I have this narrative resource that gives me access to the dangerous part, but I don't want to have, like, I have this narrative resource that lets, oh, I have access to the silver, you know, the true cross, or the horde of angry villagers. I can just go and overwhelm the bad guy. that's kind of a very fine line.
I gotta tell you,
either go.
Player agency sounds like, what we're talking here, sounds like a fabulous way to tell a story, particularly in pulp. And I am desperately trying to find time in my life to run some Hollow Earth Expedition, because it looks like the kind of game where it's this environment, the pulp environment, that adventure involving highly diversely skilled, really competent players or characters like Doc Savage or the Shatter or whatever, or Indiana Jones, is the kind of thing where cooperative plotting and cooperative storytelling between the game master and the players seems like it would really come alive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean,
because these aren't horror games. I mean, there could be nasty elements to it, but they're not. Pulp characters are not helpless. Pulp characters always have this, you know, the knockout gas, you know, grenade hidden in their coat button, you know, or they always, can pick the lock because it's a, you're going to get captured. It's a trope. They have to reveal the plan somehow. You're always going to get captured. You're always going to escape. You're always going to punch the Nazi off the top of the Zeppelin, you know. That sounds like the perfect environment for this sort of player agency. But the whole point of horror is, you know, loss of control.
Right. And the reason that the sort of traditional games work is because the rules the rules kind of enforce that on the players in the same sense that the sort of fictional reality is enforcing it on their characters, right? So you as a player don't have an out any more than your character has an out in that situation.
Yes.
And so Ryan, it sounds, you know, if I remember right, that was exactly the issue that you were sort of wrestling with a couple of years ago, talking about Fate with its sort of aspect and fate point economy with which players can ameliorate their situations and so forth.
It was
using that for that kind of suspense.
And it was even like, a lot more immediate emotional impact than even just I'm going to get out of this. This was about the fact that you could pause the game in between, like, you know, a revelation and consequence to decide if you wanted to get out of it.
Yeah,
and that was powerfully disruptive.
Right, right. You were giving the example of sort of in a traditional whatever horror game, it's I don't know, make the dodge roll to not get wrapped up in the tentacles, right? Okay, I made the roll. I fail. I'm wrapped up in the tentacles. Oh, fuck. As opposed to if you've got some kind of economy of control over that narrative, then it may be I make the dodge roll. I blow it. Okay, how much is it worth to me to spend points to get out of having blown it?
Right.
And you're talking about is that moment of you've lost that sort of impact of that instant. Yeah.
It can be really disruptive. And that's why in
That sounds like the kind of thing that's fixed by moving the decision to spend.
No, I do not like those mechanics at all. I do not. And in Fate, that actually really doesn't work at all. But I will. So, yeah, no, that breaks Fate in a worse than not having it in the first place.
Could there be anything more helpless than, you know, making the decision to do the spend and then find out that from the result of the dice you didn't have to?
I actually don't find that helpless. I find that utterly frustrating, and it creates a completely different. Like, and I don't mean frustrated as in like I mean as a player, I'm like, oh well, that just sucked, and I'm more angry about that than the fiction. So that's that's more disruptive to a horror game for me than the fate thing. That's I like a lot of the ideas of Gumshoe. I just don't like the core spend mechanic on the roll, because I'd rather just like do this horrible thing. Holy crap! Like, that's why I like Apocalypse World style stuff, is because it is just, okay, you're in a horrible situation. What do you do? This roll. Okay. Oh crap! This thing happened. Go. Mm-hmm. And that also kind of creates, like, with the spend too, you have the hem and haw at the beginning. It's still a disruptive element. Okay. But it's a disruptive element in a different place. And I watch the people who like that in Gumshoe, and I totally get them liking it. It's for me. I get crunchy in the math, and I'm like, oh, now I'm thinking about math, and then it kind of disrupts my own flow.
So we've been looking at Gumshoe. Ross, what's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I have another group of players that I'm introduced them to Call of Cthulhu. I actually posted the first game they ever played recently on the site, called Hex Hollow, set in 1920s Pennsylvania, and they had fun with it. It was related to the Pennsylvania Dutch Hex murders, and you know, there were shenanigans and tractors theft and, you know, murder, and they had fun with it. But then last night I ran Shanghai Bullets for them in Trail of Cthulhu, and I asked them, well, you guys want me to run Mass Annihilothotep, would you rather me run it in Call of Cthulhu or Trail of Cthulhu? And like three of the four players said Trail by a far margin, because they had like one of the players was saying, like, I feel like I'm not gambling every time I go out and do something by rolling the dice. I'm not as reckless. I'm going to have, like, I would have just, in Call of Cthulhu, I would have hassled these people for information until I would have been beaten senseless. But now I'm like, well, let me hold back. I can be a little more strategic about where I direct my investigation. And the fact is, in Gumshoe, all your narrative control the players have is informational, really. Like, they can't make the monsters less terrifying. They can't make them less dangerous. All they can do is figure out exactly how the monster is going to devour their souls or whatever before they get eaten. I mean, it's not a reassuring thing. I mean, I've also played in recently purist Call of Cthulhu, Trail of Cthulhu adventures, The Final Revelation, which is just very, very Lovecraftian, very, very bleak, very much you're gonna go crazy no matter what kind of adventures. They're like, you know, one of them is a color out of space adventure, so you get it, and that's the lightest one. That's like the least the most cheerful out of the four adventures I felt. So it's still very horrifying, because the players had a lot of trepidation when they were getting close to the monster, and the mythos, you know, elements of the scenario, because they knew they were still fairly fragile and their resources were very few. So they got tense at the right moments. They weren't like, but they weren't just like, whatever, I just rolled ice. You know, it was interesting to get their perspective on it, because they felt in Call of Cthulhu, they were just like, whatever, I just got to keep hitting things until I find something.
That's fascinating to hear that reaction, because it sounds, what you're saying is that in Call of Cthulhu, not having that spendable resource or that sense of control over that spendable resource, they felt like their main recourse was just to sort of keep hitting the dice until they got what they wanted.
Yeah, that's what they felt like, because, you know, a lot of times in Call of Cthulhu, you roll double up when you trying to spot a really important clue or something like that, or like the players don't have the exact right skill or the put enough points into the right skill in order to open up the right NPC or find the right clue. So they saw it as like, just do as many things as possible until we can get clues, regardless of the risk. You know, we just got to keep hitting things until we do that. But in this, they like, no, let's not shoot everyone and kill everyone or attack everyone. Let's be, we know we can get the clues. Let's just, you know, be a little more cautious about what
That I find that endlessly fascinating. In the Delta Green rules, we make a big point of sort of laying out and encouraging the keeper, the game master, you know, to sort of think mindfully of what it's going to mean when you ask somebody to roll dice, or when you require them to roll dice, you know, and to basically make a only use a skill roll if you're, or call for a skill roll or a stat roll if you want the result to be variable. You know, if you want it to be unpredictable, and
and certainly you don't want to make them roll dice if they actually say something concrete.
Right.
I mean, the example from Masks was inside the Penhue Foundation. There's a secret passage that is activated by pushing the eyes in on a mummy case.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Great. You push those eyes in and it opens up the secret passage. So there's a die roll to discover this. It's like you must critically, right, you know, succeed in a spot hidden roll. But we had a player, just because they'd seen a movie, yeah, that was in, said, fuck it, I pushed the eyes on the sarcophagus. Yep, giant secret passage opens up. Like, you're fucking kidding me. Oh, no, yeah, roll required.
Well, in writing that scenario, this is a scenario written 30 years ago, but that would have been a great opportunity for the author to, instead of, say, make a critical spot hidden roll, to give some kind of oblique clue to hint at the eyes or the answer, and not make it about rolling at all, unless they just didn't do it. And even in that case, leave it up to the game master to say, you know what, I really want them to be in here, so I'm going to find a way to clue them in.
Yeah. Masks certainly suffers from some of its – it suffers from its time and its place when it was written. Yeah. It's almost not really properly – measured against the mechanics of Call of Cthulhu. Do you know what I mean? The rules as they existed in 1983 or whatever just do not seem to, in my opinion, to support some of the stuff that goes on in this in that campaign. That's a campaign where you're losing sand points because you looked at a statue.
Right.
Because it's awful. And I'm like, what is it, supernatural off? Is it draining my soul? Is it moving? Is it wriggling? Nope, it's just statue. Roll D4 sand loss. And that's a little expensive, considering all the other horrible shit you're going to run into.
It's wonderful, but it kind of shows its age.
Yeah. Certainly.
Well, there is a conversion guide for Trail of Cthulhu, so I will be using that since they've
chosen. That would be a really good idea, because it is the game is written super pulpy, but you're – the action is super pulpy in that game, but at the same time, you're given these incredibly prosaic, normal, mundane characters to run through it.
Yeah.
You know, then the rules do not support that pulp action at all.
Well, there is one related kind of issue, which isn't specifically related to game mechanics, but I would like to ask you, because this came up for me when I was running Shanghai Bullets, because again, these are players who are new and not... and so there's a question of how much coaching or collaboration I think the GM has, in the sense like in suggesting options, and also like providing interpretations for clues, like how, like, because I mean, I really hate games where all the players are lost, you know, just adrift, they're floundering, and there's nothing interesting going on. They don't know where the cult lair is. They can't figure out the clues. They can't find the scenario. And so how much nudging is allowed before it becomes nudging turns into railroading at a certain point? But, you know, where is that line for you as a GM? I mean, like, how much when you just tell them do this thing, you're taking away their agency.
Well, start with Ryan, because he's the one who's got to run. So let's get his take.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ran into something like this when I was doing an Octon Cthulhu test scenario, and we ended up having a like massively derailing moment, because I just mentioned, like, instead of doing the, you know, find the next thing that I wrote down on this piece of paper because I wrote stuff down, I ended up just throwing out, like, you get those moments where you throw out something and everyone just latches onto it and they spend like the entire scenario or something.
Charlie, like, Chaplin.
It's like, oh, there, you said that there was some sort of raccoon that ate a person. I want to investigate that for a while. I'm like, okay, well, and you know, that was just sort of some color that I threw out there that was just funny to me. And when we got to that point, I ended up saying, like, okay, cool, we can do this. Just so you know, the cost of doing this is going to be that you're going to miss that train. that is, you know, and you need to get to this guy. That's totally cool, though, if you want to save this place from a raccoon that is eating somebody. Like, and they're like, no, this is horrible. Like, you said that, like, it might be a ghost raccoon. Or I forget exactly what it is, and the way I'm saying it makes it sound silly. They were terrified of this. And so I ended up just sort of breaking for a moment saying, this is what this is going to cost. Are you guys cool with that? And then, you know,
well, that's just reminding them of the conditions. That's not coming out and saying you guys are chasing down a false lead.
Yeah. You know,
that's not you didn't just come out and say, players, you're wasting your time.
Well, I guess in that case, I mean, I would end up making the false lead the true lead if I was, you know, feeling like, yeah. I mean, that
Schrodinger's plot hook.
Yeah, and that doesn't really sound like that to me. That isn't a player agency issue. That's just, you know, a place went somewhere. And I will have to judo it to get it to where I have prepared stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't see that as a player agency thing.
As an aside, I would have to say, like, if I was a player, I mean, depending on how that raccoon was described, I would probably be terrified of his too, because
well, they were
for me, the
out.
The single scariest thing I've ever encountered in a game was in a Delta Green game that Caleb ran that we were basically a green box had been damaged in a storm and we had to go inventory its catalog its inventory. And so we are opening up these boxes of this weird stuff and then we pull out this bird cage and there's a parrot in it alive. And this is a green box that has not been touched in like a decade. And it's just a bird in a cage. And we're like, what is this? we didn't even try to open the cage. We didn't even try and kill the bird. We were just terrified of this bird. Don't turn your back on it. Yeah, no, it was more terrifying.
Don't leave anyone alone in the green box with the bird.
Yeah.
It's just
that's mine. Yeah.
It's just the most random stuff. Like this ended up coming to me because in the middle of the game, I remembered a time when an actual raccoon in the middle of the night jumped down to being like 2 feet above me on a fence. Yeah. And I'm like, I just freaked the hell out and just walked away gently from the fence. And so I just captured that sort of moment of utter dread and threw that in there.
Right.
Nice. But yeah, I don't know if I see that as a player agency thing as so much as that's just a narrative flow thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like we're kind of, you know, we're for our small little group, we've got a fair amount of, I don't know, some consensus in terms of the talking about player agency as a part of the rules and as a part of the game, as something that the players can choose to do to exert control over their situation, that, you know, that there are very small layers of that seem to work for some of us in terms of in Trail of Cthulhu or in Night's Black Agents, where you can spend points in order to avoid having to roll dice or in order to have access to a source of information that's not totally game breaking, but it's useful.
Or shorthand your equipment list.
Right. And then beyond that, the sort of mechanical ways that winds up playing out tend to be kind of too disruptive. You know, they tend to be something that might feel appropriate if you're playing a game where you want the characters to feel like they're in control, you know, and therefore you want the players to feel like they're in control. You're playing the Robert E. Howard action game as opposed with Cthulhu, as opposed to the H.P. Lovecraft bleak existential nothingness game with Cthulhu.
Well, certainly, you know, one of the things I think that would adds to a horror scenario is that I've certainly had situations where players are like, you know, well, I want to go get, you know, I want to have this item. Okay, you do.
Right.
And, oh, really? Yeah, you're out in the world. It's you're in the world. You need to go to a Fireman Dime and buy a shotgun. They have them in the 1920s or whatever my, you know, current milieu I'm playing in. I wish I had a contact who knew something about this information. Well, you do. And they suddenly it's like, oh, yeah, great. And, you know, not because there's a mechanic or there's a rule, but I'm just keep providing, you know, that stuff's all available until you get to the horrifying part.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly that stuff dries up.
Mm-hmm.
All of that evaporates. now that you're in some sort of crisis where you're out at the farmhouse and it's isolated and there's no way to get back to town and there's no telephone and or the cell phone coverage fails or whatever it is you're going to do. Yeah. Or Narlathotep just talks on your cell phone when you try and use it.
Hey, what's going on?
Yeah, that, you know, without a mechanic there that the GM has suddenly decided has stopped working, you know, it wouldn't feel like it would feel unpleasant and disempowering and terrifying, and but it wouldn't feel like the GM just went, okay, you know that rule about spending points? We're taking that away from you now so that it'll be scarier.
So there's a mechanic from Burning Wheel that I love for this sort of situation. It's been a long time since I played, so I'm sure I'm going to botch it. But it's the circling mechanic where if you want to know somebody, you can roll your circles to know them. And there are two outcomes. You know them and they like you and will help you, or you know them and they hate you.
Mm-hmm.
there isn't that third option of you don't, or there might be, but the important part is that it's, you know, like, yeah, dude, you know, do I know somebody in town who will sell me a shotgun? And like, yeah, sure, roll. Like, yeah, your brother will totally sell you the shotgun, you know, the one you've been feuding with that inheritance over. Or you might turn the shotgun on you. You want to go in that store? It's the only one in town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing where you can create that, you know, like, yes, you have some agency, but with consequences as opposed
that's quite
consequential. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's maybe one of the problems with this aspect in horror is that when I think of it applied to pulp, I think of it as only a positive thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
That this kind of agency, this kind of mechanic is only a positive thing to the players, as opposed to a situation where, you know, it could backfire on them, which sounds like we're back into horror country when, you know, it could backfire when it might not work out as well as they'd hoped, or it might be a detriment. But the question is whether or not it's a detriment that'll derail the plot, derail the story.
Can I share my favorite way of putting player agency that makes everyone else freak out?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Okay.
Of course.
Excellent. I say that as a lead in to just do it.
You were going to do it. He was going to do it.
Yeah, I was going to do it anyway, but I wanted to trumpet it, to have a herald for it. So my favorite bit, and I learned this from running Don't Rest Your Head, which is a horror trope of very much about insane insomniac superheroes, and I've used it since in some more straight horror games, where I'll have a trigger moment of something freaky happening. Like, there's suddenly a hand, like you're walking down in this, you know, in this creepy mansion, like there's suddenly a hand on your shoulder. And I'll just turn to another player, like, what color is that hand? I mean, you know, what is it? I mean, green, purple, what? And like, red? I'm like, yes, it's totally red. So there's this red hand on your shoulder. There's just a hand just suddenly out of nowhere. Oh, it just fell off you. What do you do? And I would slowly do that where I'd ask other people to basically add horrific things that I'm doing to other folks. Like, they hear a sound. Hey, you, Bill over there. What's that sound like?
Mm-hmm.
A train? I'm like, yes, it sounds like a train. Yeah. And getting them to answer each other's horrible stuff made them start to be uncomfortable with each other. And that was so awesome.
Yeah, and Don't Rest Your Head sounds like the perfect game for that. I mean, that's a game about sort of feeling like you're being disconnected from reality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've used it since for, like, I'll use it for more for straighter games where I don't – there's a detail that I have not written in that I don't – it's not that I don't care about it, because I will care about it when it's answered. It's just that I don't need to know more about it in order to move things on. And I leave lots of little holes when I'm making, like, I don't even write really adventures. I write little skeletons of, here's a bunch of things that are probably going to happen and some stats that I can refer to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like leave little holes in for other people to fill in all the time, so that they're not just looking at me as a sense of horror in the world, but they're looking at each other, and it subtly creates a sense of alienation. So I use their own ability to answer, you know, questions and add to the world as a way to make them more afraid of the world.
Right, right. Now, because that doesn't feel like they're asserting control over things as much as they're just sort of fleshing out the things that are going to be ugly.
Right.
Yeah.
But they are still contributing at the same time. So even the other great thing is that when it's not their go, you can still wrap somebody into what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Neat.
All right. Neat.
All right. Well, any other thoughts there? We probably ought to wrap up. Ryan has important business meeting to attend, and I'm sure
he has an assignation to get to in a hotel room.
Yes.
All right. So this has been Unspeakable, episode 11. It's produced by Ross Payton for The Unspeakable Low. This episode's music is Nyarlathotep by The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets, courtesy Divine Industries, copyright 2014. Visit thickets.net.
Ryan, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And best of luck with backstory cards wrapping up. And everybody remember that when Ryan's birthday week comes up next week?
Yeah, it's next week. I turned 36 on July 22nd.
All right.
But if you hear this in the far future, pretend that is my birthday week and say something fun about games.
Say something fun about something you've been doing in games.
36. Who are these fucking children?
Surrounding.
Yeah, that's exactly why I said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're too bad you won't get any older.
All right. We'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks a lot, guys. See ya.
See you guys.
Bye-bye. Adios.
Help me, Fuyetian, the other day. Oh, Fuyetian, the other day. Step a shoe to help me.